Allow me to introduce our two speakers. I will give the introductions for both, beginning with the introduction of the mayor, then I'll introduce the professor, and then after both introductions have been offered, they will come up first. They will come up and speak sequentially, one right after the other, the mayor speaking first and then the professor. So let me say a word of introduction about our first speaker. Mike Rawlings became the mayor of Dallas when he was elected in June 2011, bringing three decades of high-level business and civic leadership to Dallas City Hall. Mayor Rawlings came to the city in 1976, the bicentennial year, with $200 in his pocket. Is that significant? 200 years, $200? After taking an entry-level job in one of Dallas's top ad agencies, he worked his way up to become the CEO of Tracy Locke, which at the time was the largest advertising agency in the South. After a successful 20-year career in marketing and advertising, Mike Rawlings took the helm of the world's largest pizza company, Pizza Hut. Under his leadership, the company had a major upturn in business, resulting in the highest weekly store sales in Pizza Hut history and recognition by D Magazine as the best company to work for in Dallas. After that period of service, he served as managing partner of CIC Partners, providing business counsel and capital, helping to grow small and mid-sized businesses. And along the way, he served as a volunteer leader with a proven track record of tackling some of our city's toughest challenges. He is, in fact, the one person in the room, as far as I know, who can claim the title czar. Because he served as homeless czar in the city for 5 years, overseeing construction and the opening of the bridge. Under Mike's leadership, Dallas reduced its number of chronically homeless persons by nearly 57% over 5 years. He has been chair of the Dallas Convention and Visitors Bureau for a year, the 2006-2007 year. He even has a television show named after him. It's called Park and Recreation. In that, he served as president of Dallas Park and Recreation Board. In 2007, he received the Innovation Award from the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, the Dallas Historical Society's Award for Excellence in Humanities, and the Anti-Defamation League's Humanitarian of the Year Award for 2010. He's a graduate of Boston College, where he earned his bachelor's degree in philosophy and communications and lettered in football. Today, he serves on the Board of Trustees of Jesuit College Prep. He's been an active lecturer at many universities, including SMU, where he's been an adjunct professor. Mike and his wife, Mickey, have raised two children here in Dallas. They're adult children. I invite you to offer a word of thanks to Mayor Mike Rawlings for his being here. Our second speaker will be Professor William J. Abraham, known to everybody as Billy. Billy Abraham was born in Northern Ireland, educated there and including Queen's University in Belfast, went on to receive a Master of Divinity degree from Asbury Theological Seminary in the United States and a Doctorate of Philosophy of Religion from the University of Oxford in England. He has held a number of faculty positions, but most of them right here at Perkins School of Theology. He actually began his teaching career at Seattle Pacific University in the state of Washington. In 1985, came to Perkins as the McCreelis Professor of Evangelism and Professor of Philosophy of Religion. He's been at Perkins then since that time, 1985. In 1995, he was appointed the Albert Cook Outler Professor of Theology and Wesley Studies here at Perkins School of Theology at SMU. He has been working in the field of philosophical and systematic theology in the Wesleyan tradition for all of these decades. His contributions have been recognized in a number of ways. He was the MacDonald Visiting Professor of Evangelical Theology at Harvard Divinity School in 2000. In 2003, SMU named him an Altshuler Distinguished University Teacher. He is the author and editor of more than a dozen books. His work on evangelism is widely recognized as igniting a new era of scholarship devoted to critical reflection on this important and vital ministry of the church. Currently, Professor Abraham is involved in research that focuses on the relationship between theology and terrorism, on the nature and history of Methodism, on the epistemology of theology. No, it is not. It is not a disease, as he said, but there will be a quiz after the lecture. He also has done work on the comprehensive content of systematic theology, and he has convened an international body of philosophers and scientists who are working at matters of how human beings know what they know, which, by the way, is epistemology. He has a contract with Oxford University Press for a four-volume work on divine agency and divine action. And he recently received a grant of $200,000 for a three-year project on analytic theology with students and faculty from Southern Methodist University, the University of Notre Dame, and Cambridge University. Meanwhile, to keep himself busy, he has traveled the globe and worked with a variety of persons who are taking initiatives in faith development in a number of places. His visits have included Karaganda, Kazakhstan, Romania, and San Jose, Costa Rica. He has been a visiting lecturer in Singapore, in Kathmandu, Nepal, and in Cebu, Malaysia. Billy Abraham is an ordained minister in the United Methodist Church, and one final note, he's my Sunday school teacher at Highland Park. Please join me in welcoming Billy Abraham. Mayor Rawlings, we look forward to your remarks.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you for having this event. One of my favorite books is Yale criticist Harold Bloom. He's got a book called Where Shall Wisdom Be Found? It's an excuse for him to kind of do a whole history of literature. But I love the title because I think about that all the time. And it's in places like this that wisdom shall be found. And so thank you for doing this, for coming up with the idea and for executing it so well. I will say I'm intimidated, not the least being talking in front of Billy with that resume. That'll be. But I will say we've got several people that go to my church in this audience, so it's always tricky to talk about faith, and you can probably go to them to see if I live it or not. You know, also, I think it's important to talk about the title of this, Faith and Business. I am a businessman by trade. That's how I've spent my 35 years here in Dallas. But I speak to you today as mayor. Someone once said in the campaign, they said, now you politicians feel this way and this way. And I said, wait, I'm not a politician. And the guy looked at me and said, yes, you are. You're a politician now. So I think as a politician and as a civic leader that I speak to you today, but I will be using much of my business experience and knowledge that has informed my comments today. Lastly, I'm intimidated because I'm talking about faith. You know, it is probably the most important thing in my life. And religion and theology, there's probably nothing more important. And I am fearful of speaking today or any time and trivializing a faith that started with a supreme being that named himself Being Itself. You know, but you go, we're talking about some pretty heavy stuff here. And so for me to kind of put this in the context of 2011 in my life, hopefully I will do it justice. I thought I would do it in three acts, if you will. One is to talk a little bit about my faith journey. Second, talk about faith in public life. And then lastly, my impression of the faith community in Dallas, because I've gotten a fair experience of it, and I thought maybe it would be interesting to you to hear what I'm seeing out in the community. I was born the grandson of two preachers. So my mother and father were very young when they had me, and they were both preachers' kids. My grandfathers were preachers of the Nazarene Church, the offshoot, Wesleyan offshoot, and the Methodist world. And I literally was in church 4 to 5 times a week. Whether it was anytime the lights were on, that was our job to be there. Went to every church camp imaginable, was in every Bible quiz imaginable. I felt I could teach Sunday school by the time I was in sixth grade, because I had heard it all. But you know what it gave me was a profound sense that this is the most important thing that a person deals with in his life. His relationship with the beyond, with God. And if you kind of try to struggle at that issue, somehow the other things fall into place. I realized that the Nazarene and my grandparents were not the center of the universe when I was in high school and told my grandfather Rawlings, who was a staunch Republican and very fundamentalist guy, that I had played football in high school. He knew that, but I had been recruited and decided to go to Boston College, which was a Catholic school. And he reminded me that it wasn't just happenstance that Catholic and communism both started with a C. So at that point, I realized, okay, there's probably a different point of view out there going on. But I packed my bags and went off to Boston and became a philosophy major of all things, where I was thrown in the midst of the Jesuit world, men for others, and great thinkers. And it gave me a whole nother perspective on my view of life, my view of faith, and really structured my ability to think through difficult issues. I left there, came to Dallas, and became a Presbyterian. I don't know how that happened, but I love the Presbyterian Church. I love their focus on grace, realizing it's not about me, but it's about God. And it's humbleness that it creates in my everyday life. I will tell you that faith in my journey was very important in my deciding to become mayor. I took a phone call last holiday. My son and I were skiing. And my son, who was doing his last semester at Boston College, ironically, was in the car. And I had said, no, I've said no, I don't want to be mayor. I don't think it's right. And I hung up the phone. I turned to my son. I said, this is a great moment to kind of do a father-son teaching thing. We were driving for several hours. And I said, well, what do you think? what do you think I should do? In fact, don't tell me what I should do. I said, tell me how I should approach this situation. Okay? Think, tell me about this. What questions should I ask myself? I said, I've told you way too much in your life. Now it's your chance. He looked at me, thought for a long time, which worries you when any kid thinks. And he said, I think you should ask, what would the righteous man do? I'm screwed. All these years, forcing him to go to church, sending him to Jesuit and on to Boston College, I said, I'm in trouble. I immediately said, it's not that simple. Isn't that what you're supposed to answer? And I said, first of all, you've got to want to be mayor. I don't have this burning desire to be mayor. And he explained all the biblical stories of people that didn't want to do things. I said, this is not going the direction I want to go. So we thought a lot about it. My wife and I prayed over it, and we decided to take the leap of faith about a year ago, in a couple of weeks. It's a tough decision, getting into public life when you're a business person. But ultimately, we felt it was the right thing to do, and every morning I've woken up. Since I made that decision, I knew it was the right thing. And I think it's got to be a personal decision, but for me, faith was an important part of the decision. So let me tell you my confession, if you will, of faith. First of all, I start from a kind of a bizarre place. I believe in the absurd. Albert Camus is one of my favorite writers. I think this world is crazy. Every time you turn around, the absurd is happening right before your face. And you can't even explain the stuff that happens. And I won't even go into the papers and the stories that we all have. Forget about reality TV. But it's there. So the question is that it, or is there something behind it? Well, I also believe in good and evil. Maybe I like, Star Wars or whatever, but I do believe there is a force underpinning this world that's fighting for good. I also believe that God is good. There's a great tradition in the African American church when you stand up and you say, God is good, they respond, all the time. And then you say, all the time, God is good. And that is an important premise to realize that not only God is being itself, I am, but goodness itself. I believe evil is the absence of God. It's the absence of that goodness. So we have absurdity here. We have a battle for good and evil, and we believe, and I believe, in the metaphysical entity that we call God fighting for that goodness. I also believe in the mystic, magical notion of the incarnate God in Christ. An amazing story that teaches us and gives us a guidepost to how we deal with this absurdity that we live in and how we deal with good and evil. The guideposts that are most important to me are his two greatest commandments, he says. Thou shalt love thy God with all thy heart, all thy mind, and all thy soul, and thy neighbor as thyself. We make theology pretty complicated. Not that that's not, nothing wrong with that. As Seinfeld says. But But Christ made it pretty simple, right? Everything we do should be focused on loving God and that we should love our neighbor as ourselves. That gets a little complicated because the question is, who's your neighbor? And the question is, do I love myself? Which is pretty heady. But if we love ourselves and we love our neighbor equally, and we figure out who our neighbor is, then we should be able to do that. So my next signpost about the neighborness is what he went on to say in The Good Samaritan. That's one of the reasons why John and I, have spent time in working with the homeless. Because it's not a metaphor. It really is the guy in the street that somebody left abandoned. And I think as we think about who our neighbor is, that's where we start to discuss how faith and the public life come into play. Now, the question is strategic leverage, as far as I'm concerned. Now I'm going to talk about business. You've only got a certain amount of capital. You've only got a certain amount of human capital. You've only got a certain amount of time. How are you going to leverage that to make the biggest impact? There's an old ethical question. If you see a child drowning and you've got a fancy suit and some shoes on, would you jump in and get that child even though it was run? And the answer is, of course I would. But would you sell, would you spend as much money saving a kid in India? Probably not, because that one's immediate. But there's a bigger question is, and that is, can you use that capital, that time, that money, and figure out how to leverage it with other things to make us save five kids in India versus the one kid that's drowning in this pond? And that's where, to me, the interesting discussion comes about how we use our time. Now, one bias I have, and I'm going to move from preaching to meddling here, I think, is that I believe that business men and women have been given an unbelievable gift. They have to figure out how to take care of customers, like our good mayor does, and make a great return on that equity and take care of shareholders at the same time, as you mentioned in your prayer. A tough situation. But somehow the successful ones figure out how to do it. How do I keep my team happy? How do I keep my costs down, my customers up, and the profits going up at the same time? That's hard. But there are a group of business people that have done that before. And I think it's very important for any business person that calls themselves a Christian to figure out how they take the talent that is given to them to leverage back for good. A calling is basically taking God's greatest gift to you to the world's greatest needs and matching those up. Now, too many people say, well, I'm going to make a bunch of money and I'm going to give it away. Well, it's not the money that is most valuable. It's the know-how, how to deal with issues like health care, like poverty, like economic development. Those are hard things. And that's what we're sensing now throughout this country and in our own backyard. Now, my view of government is a simple one. And that is that I think government is about creating an opportunity for good to grow. That if we govern ourselves correctly, it creates fertile ground for us as human beings to take off. And when we don't have fertile ground, and it's back to the another where the mustard seed is, or not the mustard, the seeds are thrown on the good soil and the rock, nothing grows. And our job is to make sure everybody in this city, this country, has that opportunity to grow. I do not believe that the role of government is legislating goodness. I know that's tough on either side of the aisle. That we get into moral choices, which is inherently about faith at times, but moral choices and goodness can sometimes be very, very confusing. And so as my job as mayor, I'm saying, am I working towards good by creating an opportunity for goodness to grow? Now, I'm a pretty optimistic guy about Dallas. I'm not generally optimistic. I've kind of been successful by being a little bit more of a glass half empty person. But it's tough to do that in Dallas right now. There's so many exciting things happen. We are lighting the lights on the Margaret Hunt Hill Bridge tomorrow night, aren't we, Gail? Okay? And we're going to open it to the public in 2 months. The park over Woodall Rogers is going to combine uptown and downtown. We've got the Perot Museum of Science and Nature. SMU won a bowl game. I mean, there's just amazing... amazing things that are happening. And I ask myself, why is that? And the answer is about the people. I believe we are more optimistic, we're more can-do, and I made a point in the paper recently that we did a poll in the United States where we asked people in the United States, are the best days ahead of us or behind us? And the same for Dallas. In America, 45% said the best days were ahead of us. 44% said the best days are behind us. A little bit of a malaise. Dallas, 65% of us said the best days are ahead of us. 15% said the best days are behind us. An amazing sense. This is not an urban myth. We are more optimistic. What is thrilling to me is the minority community is more optimistic about the future than the Anglo community. So I think there's something there. The question is, can we focus it on some of the tough, tough issues we all deal with, that Larry James works with every day in working with the working poor? These are difficult issues, but they are the reasons why I decided to run. Now, one of the other reasons I feel optimistic is because the importance of the faith-based community in the city of Dallas. I thought it was there, but... when you start to run and you go to every church in town, you get a different perspective on this. And it is amazing, the scale, first of all. I'd love to see a number of churches per square mile. And besides Northern Arkansas, Dallas has got to be right up there, okay? It's amazing. And the amount and the talent and the people and the passion, unbelievable passion in this town around faith. It's humbling. I feel not like a believer sometimes when I'm in these churches and there's so much going on. So I see passionate. I also see segregation. Unbelievable segregation. I don't know why it is, and I think our theological leaders must wrestle through this problem of why we have 99.9% of whites go to, you know, in one church and 99.9% of African Americans and the Hispanics are another place, and of course the Greek Orthodox do their thing, you know. But it's amazing, and I'm not trying to be critical of anyone. I really am not. I'm just saying it's a phenomenon that nobody talks about. And we haven't wrestled through this issue as a city. But I think it's fabulous, the passion we've got. I see four groups out there. And this isn't I didn't read this in a book. This is my sense of things. I do see the main lines, okay? And I see that as more orthodoxy. The Jewish, Catholic, you know, the traditional mainline Protestants in what they're doing. I think there seems to be a more of a mission of carrying on a tradition, a great tradition over the years. Fabulous tradition. Second, as I see the African-American church as a separate organization, their theology, their preaching, their movement is all about hope and change. Third is Latino. Structure and tradition are very important there as I see them worship and what they're thinking about. And lastly, what I call the Baptists in the Bible. You know, it's a new Baptist that's going on, and this seems to be more about relevance in contemporary life. Everything's about what's happening right now. And everybody's kind of approaching it in a slightly different direction, which is okay. But they're all passionate about what they're doing. I think the big question is, how should we act as a faith-based community in this community? What should we be doing? And what I've sensed is that pastors understand the personal psychology of faith in their church. What they're struggling with is how it intersects with the world they live in. And the one thing I know this as good as I'm standing here, that we are under-leveraging the passion we have in a faith-based community because of our fragmentation and because somehow we haven't pulled all this power together. I feel like it's nuclear power, but it's just all over this. And we've got to do that. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I love being your mayor, and I'll love to answer some questions you got after Billy speaks. Thank you.
Well, let me make a confession. I'm not generally intimidated by anybody. But today is an exception, looking out across this wonderful group of people. I'm going to make very few comments upon the extraordinary speech of the mayor, and then I want to sort of push certain themes as I see it coming from the outside. I've always believed that the Nazarenes are the Jesuits of the Wesleyan tradition. And I have proof of it today. I think it's remarkable that you ended up at Boston and were taught by the Jesuits. And I think that's right in the DNA of your tradition. If you were using a dog analogy, you know, the Nazarenes are the whippets of the Wesleyan tradition. United Methodists are the, I don't know, what should we call them? The Labradors of the Wesleyan tradition. It's very important to get clear about those. And I think the training that the Jesuits and others offer is just superb. And I was absolutely fascinated by the combination of Aquinas and Camus. You don't normally get those two in the same breath. I mean, I read Camus when I was in school, and that's enough to make you miserable. I mean, it really is. I mean, Aquinas bores the rear end off you. I mean, Camus and Sartre will just make you depressed. So I think it's an extraordinary, tribute to both the Nazarenes and the Jesuits and the Presbyterians that we've got such a sane and sensible mayor in the city of Dallas. Now, I one other general comment. I think your comments about business and what business does to you and how within the culture of business there emerges a whole series of skills and dispositions and themes, I would love us to see explore that, but I can't do that here. I mean, at least theologians that I've come across tend to have a terribly thin vision of what's in the business world, and they tend to think it's all just about profit and whatnot. I think your comments about the complexity of what's involved in running a business and how there are very important moral dimensions, civic virtues that emerge within that world, I think that needs to be unraveled, unpacked, and indeed celebrated. And another way to put this, to get the word epistemology in there somewhere at least, is that you do come to know things in that world that you don't know elsewhere. This is why one of my favorite political philosophers is an Irishman called Edmund Burke. And Edmund Burke wrote his letters on the French Revolution, predicting what was going to happen, including the bloodbath in the streets. And he said that when eventually you want to put together a political a set of arrangements, it's very important that you have people who own property. Why would you say that? Because otherwise what you'll get is a bunch of eggheads who sit down and sort of just draw up a blueprint. And they do not bring the knowledge and wisdom and dispositions and skills that come out of the business world. If you own property, it's going to do certain things to you. I think that whole arena would be very interesting to pursue and look at. Now, the wider problem, of course, in some ways, the wider issue is the elephant in the room, which is the wider relationship between religion and public life. And given that the mayor is here, the wider issue is the relationship between religion and politics. I think it's an extremely sensitive issue. I think it's a fascinating issue. My favorite sport outside Notre Dame and SMU football is politics. I think it's the best blood sport that's out there. I think America. I used to think, coming out of Ireland, and I'll say a bit of word about this. Coming out of Ireland, I used to think that Irish politics was absolutely crazy until I came to Dallas, and then I saw John Wiley Price out, you know, and all the others. I thought this is I got to wise up here. I've got to figure out what's actually going on in this world. And so it seemed to me politics is absolutely fascinating. Now, I'm not an American citizen. I'm a resident alien. And my daughter has become an American citizen, very happy one. And I'll not go into the reasons why this has not happened in my case. Part of it is that I want to fill all the forms in that the bureaucracy wants. Every country that I've been to, exactly, you know, where I've been and where I've slept and so on. I just don't want to go through all that bureaucratic work. But I'm absolutely fascinated by the United States as an experiment in the relationship between faith and politics, not just faith and public life. And I would even put it more stringently, in the relationship between theology and politics. I think if we talk just generically about religion, that's soft and it's sort of it's comfortable and it's safe. But at the end of the day, I think it comes down to a very particular and interesting theological commitments that we've got and how they play themselves out in the public arena. Now, you become acutely aware of this when you're brought up in the north of Ireland. Because the north of Ireland is the fag end, if I can put it that way, of the disputes on the relationship between religion and politics, theology and politics in Europe. And that's a long history, because after we converted the Roman Empire, after the Christians converted the Roman Empire, I mean, they came along to your local clergy and said, we want you to run the trains on time. And we want you to be justices of the peace. That nearly wrecked Christianity, but we'll not get into that here. But once you have that in your DNA, and then you come to the Reformation, and you have, for each nation and each community, you have a different religion, then you've got problems on your hands. And the north of Ireland is the fag end of that. So the northern lapsed Protestants want a Protestant state for a Protestant people. And the Catholics in the south, they want a Catholic state for a Catholic people. And in the north, where I come from, split right down the middle. And what that leads to is extraordinarily complicated and difficult arrangements when it comes to resolving political issues. And that, again, I could sort of take off and give a long lecture on that, and you'd be bored to tears. No, you wouldn't be bored to tears, but I can't do that here. But what it made me sensitive to is what happened in the United States. Now, the way I want to put it in very grand terms is that you figured out a different way to resolve the relationship between religion and politics, theology and politics. When the Reformation hit and we split all over the place, ended up killing one another in the name of Jesus. And that's what produces the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was not the product of the Great Society of Noble Atheists and Agnostics. They come later. Enlightenment was simply Christians who said, you know, Descartes, Locke and company, we've got to stop killing each other. And we've got to appeal to reason, not to revelation. And then you start arguing which version of reason. Is it Locke or is it Descartes? Or is it Immanuel Kant? And then you're off to the races. Or is it Nietzsche and Camus and Sartre and the whole damn thing is absurd? The mayor is amazing the way he's ended up. Right? So the way it got resolved in Europe, just to get the contrast and I'll roll it into the United States, is that the French, unique, of course, in their own way, great footballers, great soccer players, but they resolved this fundamentally by saying no religion in the public square. So we will eliminate the church from the public square as much as possible, and we will house train anybody who's out there that wants to come into it. Better behave yourself. And that has worked relatively well. It's poisonous. We just keep it out. Now, of course, the English did it very differently. You've got to watch your wallet when you talk to the English. The Irish are religious, and it's impossible to make them moral. And the English... the English are moral, and it's absolutely impossible to make them religious. And the reason for that was that they decided to have an established church. Toleration at the edges. So we'll have nice, soft, genteel initially. Well, it wasn't very genteel initially. That's why the Anglicans are the real Labradors of the Christian tradition nowadays. But what happened is that they basically said, we will have an established church, but we'll have at the edges tolerance of Presbyterians, not if you don't believe the Trinity initially. So, by the way, John Wesley belongs to a world where you have a confessional university. You don't get to teach at Oxford or Cambridge until the 1870s if you don't believe in the Trinity and the 39 Articles. And you operate in a world where there is a confessional state. You don't get to be a member of Parliament unless you believe in the Trinity. And then over time, it opens up, Jews get in, and so on and so forth. But what they did is they resolved the issue by having an established church with tolerance at the edges and then let that play itself out. That's not the solution that it seems to me you took. What you did is you invented your own religion. It's called civil religion. So you split the difference. So what you get, and I have a long paper on this and would bore you to tears. No, I wouldn't bore you to tears. But you have your own sacred sites. You have your own scriptures. You have your own slogans, In God We Trust. You have your own founding fathers. You have your own liturgies, complete with sacred days and hymns that go along with it. You have your own prophets. You have your own theologians. Abraham Lincoln is absolutely one of them. And what you effectively did was you said, we'll allow God and theology into the public square, but it's got to be minimalist. So, by the way, it's not God as being. And that's a nice move, actually, that Aquinas makes, which I don't agree with, but we won't get into that argument here. I think God is an agent. But what you do is you develop a vision of a transcendent creator who's made you and I and the world with inalienable rights and all that good stuff, and works providentially, and on and on. So you have your own internal theology, which is minimalist, and then you have your own virtues and vices that go with that. I mean, Dallas has got one of the great virtues, which is optimism. You're going to fix things. That's partly funded out of your belief in a God who's created human beings who got free, give you opportunities, all this sort of stuff. And I want to argue, in fact, that you cannot understand American public life without understanding the civil religion, and that this is an extremely important feature of politics. Now, what more do I want to say? It's a very fragile phenomenon. It initially, by the way, was started by Protestants, and then you open up and allow Catholics in. John F. Kennedy in Houston. Jews get in. The really interesting question for the future is what's going to happen to Islam in this country. And I'm going to bet the store on this, that American civil religion and American religion and culture is so powerful that you will utterly transform Islam. And there are clear signs of that already. You're going to have a reformed version of Islam in order for it to be able to operate within the wider sector of the American tradition. Compare that, by the way, with Mormonism. Mormons got in the system when they gave up on polygamy. They had a clear divine revelation initially. I hope I'm not mistaken about this theologically. A clear divine revelation that polygamy was the best way to organize family life. And then to get into the Union, there was a particular act around the 1870s that you all know about, in which they decided, well, we got a meta-revelation. We got a revelation about the revelation. We didn't give up the revelation. We got a revelation which said, you keep that, shelve that for the time being. And that, of course, is what the fundamentalist Mormons did not do. But you got in because, in fact, you adopted the basic core of the civil religion. And I think this has been an amazing experiment. and has enabled you to speak about God, and the core of it is that you're not coercive. You're not allowed to be coercive, and you can't push it too hard. And you allow lots of heresy. And it's a big tent. So I think that the wider scene here has got to include an analysis of the place of an experiment in politics, which is a theological experiment as much as it is a political experiment. Now, I think this is coming under a tremendous strain at the moment from various sources. Part of the sources come from very tough philosophical secularists who take the separation of church and state and sort of then run with that and argue that the only kind of argument that's allowed in the public square is one where everybody can agree. It's like you have to be a lawyer to argue in that. I think this is just not going to work. Because you can't leave your faith behind if you're a Christian when you move out into the public arena. Christianity is inescapably public, and it cannot confine it to a private world, and therefore it's going to reach out into the world. And I think the hardline secularists are very keen to have their particular set of metaphysical options implemented in education and law and so on. That would take a wider argument. But that's going to be a major effort to undermine any idea of the kind of civil religion I've identified. And then the other attack will come from within Christianity itself. One side of it will be led by that little school over there, North Carolina. I think it begins with a D. Is it Duke or something they call it? Led by a fellow called Stanley Harawas, who was born outside Dallas here, and who thinks that any idea of a civil religion is idolatrous because you're not actually worshiping the real God. And that's got enormous traction within certain circles within the United Methodism. And the other way it's going to be undermined is by very strong evangelical Christians who want to say, no, we want full-blooded, real religion. We want Christianity and our version of it. And we want that in terms of the way you understand the history and the way in which, in fact, you're going to organize your life. Now, I am all in favor of your experiment. I'm just going to confess my, if you did it, I'll do it. I think this is an amazing experiment. And I hope it'll continue. I do not think it involves idolatry, because I think that the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, whom I worship and serve, is also the one and only creator of the universe, which is exactly the God identified as the God of civil religion. Secondly, I think it has proved itself extraordinarily valuable in fermenting a very rich argy-bargy and political discussion. I mean, I love the mess that you have on television. I mean, I'm serious. I mean, you just set up your poll and off you go, and all of them are committed to we're not going to kill each other. And that's the last thing I'm going to stay with. It is an incredible, wonderful achievement for a group of people, in many cases passionate people, to actually come around and say, you know, whatever else we do, we're going to argue, we will persuade, we will lay out our shingle, but whatever else we do, we're not going to kill one another in the public square. I think that's a fantastic achievement.
Our covenant with you has always been to begin on time and end on time. We have a few minutes for questions. Dorothy's going to go to the back of the room. If you have a question for either Dr. Abraham or Mayor Rawlings, raise your hand. We'll come to you with a mic, then state your question because we're recording the proceedings. I've got the first one right here.
Billy, could you tell us three of the signs that civil religion will have a positive impact on Islam that you see?
Oh yes. I think if you really want to see this laid out theologically, read the work of Tariq Ramadan. Tariq Ramadan is a Swiss Muslim theologian whose grandfather was one of the founders of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And he was not allowed initially into the United States to teach at Notre Dame because of connections with given money to the Muslim Brotherhood. But there's a whole inner reformation taking place in the work of Tariq Ramadan, in which Sharia is now being identified as the way that is seen as ethics, not law, and it has to be read in the context of reason. You have two books. This is an old Christian idea. You have the Quran and you have the Book of Nature. And you've got to read the Quran now in the light of ethics and the Book of Nature. And the next thing that you're beginning then to completely rework issues of civil liberty, women's rights, all sorts of other things that are now actually being developed as a reform version of Islam. And this is being picked up, by the way, by lawyers at Yale, Emory, and other places. It'll take a while for it to get out. People will argue about it and so on and so forth. But that's as far as I'd like to take it at this stage.
Another question. Yes.
I'd like to address this question to the mayor. I'm struck by your comments about the segregation that you observe among the churches in Dallas. I'd like to have you comment if you have any thoughts or you have any philosophies that guide you as to trying to do something about that and to bring this together to unite this nuclear force and leverage it. What can you do?
Well, first of all, I think that we do not have a form of the bishops, if you will, let's use that, of the different communities together to talk about this issue. And I've mentioned this, or this has been mentioned to me a couple times by some real godfathers of some of these groups that we need to do that, and I need to work on that to make that happen, first of all. Second, I do it in a practical way, and that is I try to attend a new church, or you know, a church that's not my home, at least three times a month, and I'm inviting people to go with me, and I think that's a very important thing. When you listen to the theology, deep down there are some differences, okay. But you, for just the average Joe, when you listen to the preachers preach, it's not much different. And when people sense that and they experience it in different ways, I think it starts to happen. And then I'm starting to really, when I see it in churches, and I have seen it in churches, to really brag on it, because there are some things over in West Dallas that are pretty diverse churches there. So those are the three things I'm thinking about right now and talking about it. I've talked about it a fair amount of time, and I don't mean it to come off as judgmental. It's just a fact of the way it is.
I'm just encouraging the same one person willing to talk about it.
Yeah.
We have a question at the back over here, and I've got one right here.
Yes. Thanks to both speakers for very informative presentations. Question would be, what would both of you like to see more so out of the business community? Government politics, and in the world of theology.
Go ahead.
Okay, I would like $30 million for Perkins.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
I'm deadly serious. I think Perkins needs to move into what I would call Perkins 4. We're in a centenary. I think that the school, the work of the graduate work is crucial. And I think that what I see at SMU, I think SMU is an extraordinary coalition of business and church and theology and whatnot. And you're going to have to take theology a lot more seriously. It's not going to go away. It's going to get worse, because the whole secularization thing is it was invented by the English. I mean, I was taught, you know, we're all going to be little Englishmen. And the religion's going to die. It's going to jump over to the United States, over the Rio Grande Valley, all the way to Africa, Asia, and everywhere. This is a complete myth. And religion is here to stand, and we need all the help we can get on the academic, on the financial front. But I think also what would be crucial, as a theologian who, I don't work normally on these issues, but I have a deep interest in, say, the intersection with politics. I think we need a much richer account of what it is to be involved in business, of what's distinctively virtuous, as well as the vices that emerge. Everybody's got vices and virtues, but what are the distinctive virtues that arise in a robust, healthy business community? I think knowing more about that would be very important for us. And that's not something you can learn if you're a philosopher. You've got to learn that from people who know.
I'm encouraged about the corpus of business in the public sector in regards to deciding how they get their employees engaged in different issues. There's not a good company around Dallas that I have seen that hasn't got some strategy that is not engaged in some issue, that's not writing a big check. So that's moving a positive direction. What I'm not seeing, I'm seeing a real chasm between business leaders and elected officials. There is a distrust like I've never seen before. And it's like I'm never, those people have leprosy. And I'm telling you, the only way that it's going to change is if people say, and there's a lot of great people that have retired, okay, that could be fabulous judges in this county. Okay, I mean, I don't mean court, you know, the county judge or the commissioner's court and things like that. And, you know, this is just 4 years of my life. I mean, you know, we need more, we need as many as we can. And if when that starts to happen, and I see it as a faith step, I see it as serving, living out the gospel as opposed to that's leprosy.
My question is just a follow-up question, and I wanted to hear from you, Billy, if you had any thoughts about the separation of churches.
Uh-huh. Very quickly on the separation of church and state, there's a distinction between the church and state. And that's a long-standing Christian distinction. The secular was initially identified as those where you engage in empirical study, you engage in good common sense reasoning, and the church has its own sphere, right? And there's definitely, I think, a great proper classical distinction between the church responsible for saving souls. Go back to the good old Nazarenes and Wesley. And when we lay that out, the church responsible for preserving and mediating the truth of the Christian tradition, including what I think is the truth of divine revelation. And I don't want the government doing that. I don't ask the government to do that. And so there's a real distinction to be made, but I think that there's a myth of the separation of church and state. I think that's just a straight-up myth that you bought. And the Mormons are my test case. I'm going to hammer away with the Mormons as the test case. And so what my position requires then is a more nuanced account as to how you walk into the public arena. So what may or may I not leave behind when I walk out into politics? I think there's a very lively discussion about that, and I think that means the idea, for example, let me finish this way, the idea that your understanding of the morality that's embodied in the law, or your idea of human flourishing that is inescapable once you get into politics. You're going to have some vision of what it is to be a flourishing human agent, and how thick you want to put that's going to be open. Those are going to be profoundly affected by your theological commitments. And the idea that we're going to separate those out and house train everybody on the way in so that you can only use certain categories and you're going to have to leave all that at the door, I think is a big mistake. Now, then the other side of that is that then I think it's down to, it's an evolving conversation, and you negotiate. You know, you sit down, you argue, and you negotiate. And how we negotiated in the north of Ireland is radically different from the way you negotiated it over here. And we got it through.
Was that your question, or were you asking about the division of churches, like denominationally or among Christian groups?
I actually was asking that question, oh. But I'm glad you gave that response.
Okay, good.
Can I fit not on that one? Oh, well, this.
The mayor talked about,
yeah, I do.
Where, you know, we say at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in the whole time.
I would say relax and don't get your underwear in a twist right now. That's number one. Number two, if there was an Irish Methodist church in Dallas, I would be in it. Right? And if I'm an African American, I do not want to go to Highland Park with an $8 million organ that's playing music that sometimes is brilliant and grand, but which doesn't have the beauty and wonder of African-American gospel tradition. Right? So I think we're going to have to deal with the way in which cultural developments get enshrined in our denominational divisions. And then what we've got to do is we're going to have some openness there. And then we're going to have to come back and say, okay, how do we move together to do exactly the kind of things that the mayor is after?
Let's thank the mayor, and we don't have time, I'm sorry, and Billy.